Now, on the case of Board of County Commissioners of Summit County versus James, Hazel, and Jason Rogers. And this case is set for 1 hour. May I have the entry of appearances, please, first for the Summit County Board?
Sure. Good morning. Josh Marks, Ms. Heidi Potter, and Jeff Hunter, the county attorney for Summit.
Okay, Mr. Marks, will you be doing the entirety of the argument?
I plan to do most of it except for about 5 minutes.
That's fine, but nobody else from your side will be talking? Just you, okay, good enough. And who's here for the respondents, please?
Good morning, Your Honor, it's Heather Hodgson. I represent the respondents, Jason Rogers and Jason.
All right, very good. So, Mr. Marks, as you anticipated, you'll have to keep track of your own time, and if you do want to reserve some time, that's fine. But just you need to keep track of that yourself. So whenever you're ready to start, sir, go ahead.
May it please the court, I am Josh Marks, representing the Summit County Board of County Commissioners. It must be equal protection day for this court because this is the second case in a row involving that constitutional provision. This case provides this court with an opportunity to help define the scope and reach of Rule 50 and how it applies in the case. My intent today is to address basically two things. One is to urge this court to use this as an opportunity to indicate that Rule 50 allows for trial courts to direct partial directed verdicts, meaning, and when I say that, I mean on claims, on cases where there's multiple claims, and on cases where there are the functional equivalent of multiple claims in a case, such as in our case. And then the second point I want to reach in this case is that, what I want to address with you is that the Court of Appeals, when it attempted to apply the directed verdict rule, mischaracterized and misunderstood the nature of the claims that was before the trial court. And in so doing, it undid what was the proper application of a directed verdict in this case. And as a result, the directed verdicts on multiple theories of one equal protection claim should be reaffirmed. So, what I'd like to do is first talk about the reach of Rule 50. And as this case has progressed, it seems like there's been less and less controversy over what Rule 50 allows, at least from the first set of briefs involving the petition for cert. I think now the appellees or plaintiffs in this case almost concede that the notion of a partial directed verdict is permissible in this state. Even though Rule 50 doesn't explicitly talk about partial directed verdicts, in fact, the rule is completely silent on that. We believe that the silence is not a limiting factor in being able to apply Rule 50 to some claims, but not all the claims in the case. Now, we believe that one of the reasons that this court should make explicit that Rule 50 allows for partial directed verdicts is because, A, not only the language of the rule provides no limitation, but two, it provides some operational equity or parallel with Rule 56. This court has previously indicated that Rule 50 operates and the standard is the same as Rule 56, which allows for courts to direct summary judgment on some but not all of the claims in the case. And so it only makes sense to allow Rule 50 to operate in the same fashion since it operates under the same standard. That's also reinforced in part by another case that this court has enunciated in the Fiber Collison and Kilmer case, where this court said, in order to preserve a denial of a motion for summary judgment, you need to move it up to the trial and reassert those arguments in a Rule 50 motion. So because of that rule, it makes sense to let Rule 50 operate much in the same way as Rule 56 operates.
Council, can I just stop you there?
Because
sure. I'm wondering if you can address the linguistic differences between Rule 56 and Rule 50.
Well, I mean, you're talking about the fact that Rule 56 talks about being able to grant things in part or
right,
or
and it's
part.
Expressed there. And in Rule 50, as you've conceded, it's silent.
It's totally silent. It would be different if there was some suggestion that Rule 50 has any kind of limitation, but it does not. And I think because this court has put them on parallel tracks, Rule 50 should be borrowing from the same language as Rule 56. And I know there are linguistic differences. I just don't think they're significant.
Well, you don't think it's significant that one rule expressly allows partial and the other rule does not? I mean, I guess you just don't read anything into that omission?
Because the language of Rule 50 is so generic that there's not even an attempt to try and limit it in any way, shape, or force or form to a claim, an issue, or anything. And that's why I have trouble reading in some kind of significance to the language actually utilized in Rule 50.
Thank you.
Sure.
Isn't there a similar linguistic difference between the federal rule and the Colorado rule? And doesn't that also imply, perhaps, that there was a conscious decision to not have it operate in the fashion that you're suggesting? I think the CTLA brief talks about that.
Yeah, the problem was the way the federal rules have changed. At some point, the federal rule and the state court rule was the same. And then the federal rule was changed to its current provision, which says in part. And it's interesting that the committee notes, of course, to the federal rule, what happened was they took some of the language from the federal rule and they put it in another section. They put it in Federal Rule 59. And at the same time, the committee notes to the federal change indicated that they weren't trying to make any significant changes or any changes to Rule 50, to the Federal Rule 50. And what's happened is Colorado just never changed its rule to reflect the federal rule, but I don't think the federal rule change had a significant impact in terms of suddenly allowing partial motions for direct verdict. I think that practice remained consistent both before and after the federal rule change. So again, I don't think that linguistic difference has any significance either.
Well, doesn't it seem to suggest that maybe there's the notion is that we're clinging to a claim-by-claim adjudication?
Well, and I guess what I'm suggesting to you is, for purposes of resolving this case, that partial directed verdicts can proceed on a claim-by-claim basis, or their functional equivalent to a claim-by-claim basis, which is what happened in this case. We had one equal protection claim under Section 1983, but the way the case evolved, the plaintiffs asserted multiple theories, multiple violations of that equal protection clause in their case, and it functioned just like, instead of having five different equal protection violations, they just said, well, there's five different violations, and any one of them, if I win, is going to allow me to get judgment on that claim. So functionally, it operated just like we had five separate claims. And what I'm suggesting is that Rule 50 ought to apply equally to that circumstance, as if the plaintiffs had pled five separate equal protection claims. And that's effectively what the trial court did in the case. As the case evolved, both at the direct and verdict stage, when it started listing out the separate violations and analyzing them, the plaintiffs never objected to that. The plaintiffs' jury instructions, the carry instructions, suggested that they were proceeding on alternative and discrete theories and violations of equal protection. The summary judgment that preceded the trial broke the case down in that fashion. The plaintiffs never said, well, this is just one claim, and we've got all these decisions which go into one collective pattern and practice. They went and proceeded to analyze the case consistent with that analytical framework. So when you look at the case as a whole, you know, there were separate independent 1983 equal protection violations. And the trial court went through them and said, you haven't, you know, you didn't hit the threshold requirement in four out of those five violations. And it didn't let the case go to the jury, or those claims go to the jury. And similarly, I mean, just if there's any question about whether the verbiage makes a difference, I know this court has not drilled down that far into this rule previously. In fact, hardly any courts do, but the only, there is one court, the Texas Supreme Court, has looked at their Rule 50, which has similar language, very, very general, very vague, and they commented in a footnote in the Johnson versus Swain case, which is in our brief, that a partial directed verdict is a convenient mechanism, a convenient tool for trial courts to utilize. And had they been concerned about, you know, using that language and allowing for partial directed verdicts, you would expect a very different tone to be taken in that footnote. And in fact, as the dissent noted, there's an unpublished Texas Court of Appeals case which sees on that language and officially recognized for Texas that partial directed verdicts are just fine under Rule 50. So that may help answer your question, Justice Hart, a little more thoroughly.
So, counsel, if I could just over here.
Yes.
You are characterizing the plaintiff's claim as one overarching claim of discrimination, but with multiple theories of liability, any one of which had been proved by proponents of evidence, would have entitled them to judgment on that discrimination claim. And that's your characterization of the claim, right? If in fact you were to agree that instead it was sort of one collective, you know, pattern and practice claim, are you saying that Rule 50 ought to be interpreted in a way to allow a court to parse out evidence or pieces of that claim? Or are you, I guess what I'm trying to get at is whether your argument here really hinges on, yes, I agree that Rule 50 is sort of a claim by claim approach, and this particular claim in this case was in fact a series of separate claims.
Yeah. It's an interesting conundrum, but my interpretation does hinge on the fact that this was a series of claims, and this wasn't one theory with a bunch of little acts all put together. Because had it been, we wouldn't be sitting here either, because the trial court would have directed verdict for the lack of a comparator for this series of actions. And the trial court, in fact, mentioned that at the very beginning of its directed verdict ruling. It said, I note that the plaintiffs haven't shown anybody who has been subject to collectively all the actions that that they allege here. So, you know, so I think if you take that reading and that assumption that there was one claim and there is a series of collective actions which go into that claim, that there shouldn't have been a trial. The county shouldn't be given direct verdict. So there's real problems with that. But theoretically, I think part of the problem here is that there's a struggle between what do you use Rule 50 for? Do you get to use it to get at evidentiary rulings and say some of this shouldn't go to a jury? And I think that for purposes of the trial court, it has a number of tools available to it, not just Rule 50. I think it has motions in limine that it can utilize for evidentiary purposes. It has evidentiary rulings in court that it utilizes. And finally, I think it has, at the end of the case, the power to limit or couch the jury instructions based on the evidence that's come in. And so I think, you know, I've really struggled with this. In one sense, to create a decent bright line for Rule 50, I think it has to be based on a claim where it's functional equivalent and not just get at evidentiary rulings. But I think even if this claim was one claim with a series of acts, ultimately the trial court would come to the same place. because I think the trial court, when it came time for the to instruct the jury, would have said, you know, you haven't shown a comparator for your pattern of conduct. So how do you have a series of discriminatory acts under the protection clause when you only have shown evidence of potentially one discriminatory act? So I think the court would have come to the same place and said, the only thing you get to show to a jury here is one act of discrimination, and that's for putting a bond requirement on the plaintiffs to let them into their house pending the work that they promised they would do on the septic system. It's a long-winded answer to your question, but it's complicated, I think.
Best way for this, looking, you know, in hindsight, for this case to have been pled would have been as four discrete acts of violation of 1983 and then a fifth continuing pattern of practice kind of a claim. And then, in fact, the judge could have dismissed three of the four and the fifth continuing pattern of practice and put it forward on the one 1983 claim. And that would have been clean and nice. But it almost never comes that way, does it? I mean,
no. I mean, we see the whole gamut in terms of how so plaintiffs tend to plead their case. Sometimes they do it very distinctly, you know,
so,
precisely.
So you have to look at, I think, the civil jury instructions, which are helpful there, which establish what the elements are of a case of this sort under 1983. And I don't think the jury instructions allow this kind of evidentiary parsing when you present the case, which is a pattern in practice kind of a case, do they? I mean, isn't that the primary point where we could get some education about how these kinds of claims should be viewed?
Well, I guess the question is there something unique about the fact that this was a equal protection case in the 1983 setting,
I'm referring to the jury instructions is that helps us figure out, you know, what's an element of a claim versus what's a separate claim. And I guess that goes to the essence of this argument. Are these elements of a claim? And of course, you would never grant a directed verdict on an element of a claim.
Well, unless someone couldn't prove a critical element of a claim, they get rid of it.
Then you get rid of the claim. Yeah, right. But you wouldn't parse it out. You wouldn't say, for example, well, you can't prove intent or you can't prove causation, but I'm going to let you go forward on negligence, right? I mean, you wouldn't make those kinds of findings. So it seems to me pretty critical that we figure out whether these are all part and parcel the elements of this cause of action, which is a violation of 1983. And if, in fact, that's what it is, you have to analyze it. Or if these are separate 1983 allegations, and they simply weren't pled that way.
The pleadings don't help. I think it's as the case moves closer to trial, that's really
right.
The defining things to look at.
So the jury instructions do kind of help. And so if you could analyze how the court instructed with respect to the cause of action, this cause of action and the elements that had to be proven.
Sure. The jury instruction, well, I think that the best piece of evidence was the Caring instruction that was offered by the plaintiffs in this case before the directed verdict got issued in the case. And that jury instruction, and I know we've highlighted it in our briefs, I just don't know the number off the top of my head. It was a proposed instruction. But it very clearly said that, you know, there was two basic elements that needed to be proven, each one of these in a 1983 equal protection case. One was the issue of disparate treatment, which requires that plaintiff prove that there is someone who is similarly situated to them, who is treated differently, and that person is outside of the suspect class, you know, versus inside. And then the second issue, of course, is intent. Is for if one of those particular action is proven in terms of showing that there's a sufficient comparator, then you move on to intent. And a plaintiff must prove at that point that particular decision or action was the product of intentional discrimination and the type of discrimination, you know, that's at play in the particular case. That's what the instructions said in this case. And it's, you know, and of course it's truly significant that when it came time To describe their theories of the case, the plaintiff's carry instruction said nothing about a pattern in practice under Section 1983. And I submit to you, there's a strategic reason for that.
Can I just make sure we're all, so you're talking about jury instruction number 28?
If I can...
It also has a 3 next to it, and that's what's kind of confusing to me. And I suspect that we're talking about the same thing. That's the only one that's in the record.
The numbering sounds familiar to me. So.
All right, thank you.
If I might just interject here, because I'm seeing what appears to be the instruction actually given, instruction number 28 that's crossed out, and there's a 3 handwritten.
Yeah.
But I'm also seeing in your reply brief reference to what may have been perhaps the original tendered instruction at pages 8 and 9 of the reply brief. And I guess I'm trying to understand if you're calling our attention to the former or the instructions ultimately tendered.
Yeah, I'm calling your attention to the one that was tendered by the plaintiffs that was not given, which set forth the alternative theories.
So the one that's quoted in your reply brief?
I believe so. Correct. It's the one that's quoted in the reply brief at page 9. Yes. Yes, and we have a record cite to record at 1437-38, I believe is the record citation to it. And that's the one I'm referring to. The reason that I think it's important is I think there's a strategic reason why the plaintiffs decided to do this. Because rather than trying to claim that a series of actions were all discriminatory. I think it was easier for them to say, well, if rather than saying that every one of the decisions that underlie the county's decision to not give them their certificate of occupancy for their house was discriminatory, they only had to prove one of the acts was discriminatory and led to that decision. But that gave them the ability to claim an equal protection violation a whole lot easier than trying to prove that each and every one of the series of actions was a pattern of discrimination. And that's why I submit to you they did it in this fashion. And then in the court of appeals came an adverse ruling from the trial court. They switched gears and said, oh, well, let's go back to our pattern and practice theory of the case. And let's say that's what really was happening in the case. And that's the problem we have. I think the plaintiffs have switched horses as this case has developed to help create appellate issues in the case. And for that very reason, that's why you don't see pattern and practice cases in equal protection jurisprudence. Because equal protection clause isn't a generic prohibition against discrimination. It prohibits unequal treatment of people who are similarly situated. And so in order to have a rigorous requirement for the comparator phase of this, you have to have a sufficiently definable series of actions to apply the comparator requirement to. By saying, well, the government is just discriminating against me in a series of actions, that's not sufficiently definable to do the comparator requirement with any rigor. And so that's why you don't see, I think it's almost self-regulating. That's why you don't see plaintiffs bringing pattern and practice cases. This is a lot different from other federal statutes. For example, in the employment context, under Title VII, there's something called a hostile work environment theory of a Title VII claim, which allows for a pattern and practice of actions to be collectively looked at to determine whether someone has been the subject of discrimination in the workplace. That operates, that's a very specific cause of action which the courts have authorized, some kind of pattern and practice legal theory. Whereas in equal protection, the elements there just don't lend themselves to a generic pattern and practice.
So do you want our opinion to say what? That depending upon the kind of cases, Rule 50 should be applied differently?
No, I think...
What do you want us to say?
What I think needs to be recognized here is looking at what happened in this case, what the plaintiffs pursued before the trial court, and looking at the nature of an equal protection case, it was clear that they proceeded on basically a series of alternative theories of liability under equal protection claim, under one equal protection claim. And under those circumstances, Rule 50 allows a trial court to get rid of some of those alternative theories. That's the ruling I think is the appropriate one in this case, and it properly defines the scope of Rule 50, not only for an equal protection claim, but for other claims moving forward.
Right, I mean, you want us to come up with an interpretation of Rule 50 just that applies to all claims. Am I understanding?
Well, I'm assuming that was one of the reasons the court didn't assert was not to just...
And then how it's, right, and then how it's particular... The question number two is how it's particularly applied here.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And my thesis is it applies to, obviously... claims, multiple claims in a case where the court wants to shave off, you know, some of them, but not all of them, and it applies to functional equivalents of those claims, such as independent theories of liability. And in applying that to this case, I believe that the plaintiffs actually had independent theories of liability, and the trial court, as a result, threw out three or four, depending upon how many you count, of those theories, and let the one theory go to trial.
Judge Fox, in her dissent at paragraph 69, places some emphasis on the fact that the trial court didn't limit the plaintiff's presentation of evidence, and quotes,
correct.
The trial court is saying it's hard, but taking as a whole this collectively constituted discrimination. Does that matter for your purposes, that there wasn't any limitation on the presentation of evidence?
It really doesn't. It mattered. Well, I think Judge Fox commented to that effect because there was some concern by the majority that somehow the elimination of some of the claims affected the one claim that did go to the jury. And I believe it did not because, in fact, as you pointed out in the reply brief, there's two jury instructions that said that the plaintiff was free to marshal any evidence in the case for purposes of proving discriminatory intent, not the comparator requirement, but for intent, in support of the one theory that went to trial. And we pointed out, if you look at footnote 34 from our reply brief, the plaintiff's counsel, in fact, in closing argument, didn't limit the remarks to the evidence just in support of the one theory of discrimination. He went outside and made reference to all kinds of other actions by the county that applied to the theories that had been thrown out, such as there were references to the county's enforcement of the tank limitations of the grading regulations. There were references to one of the employees' membership in a church. So plaintiff's counsel was not limited in being able to prove evidence of intent, of discriminatory intent, in this case. And I think the majority of the Court of Appeals just simply got that wrong. It didn't, and there's an explanation behind that, and that this issue about Rule 50, the scope of Rule 50, how it was employed, was not raised by the plaintiffs in their briefs. This was something that was raised sua sponte by the Court of Appeals, and we got asked a little bit about it at the oral argument, and we were talking about things on the fly, and I wasn't able to really go back and reconstruct the record on the fly and be able to indicate to the court where, in fact, the jury instructions were, what to look at, and what evidence was presented of closing to show that they weren't limited. So that's some of the backstory behind Judge Fox's comments. She did go back to the record, apparently, and saw that the plaintiffs hadn't been limited.
Do you want to save your time? That's fine. I'll let
I've got about a minute.
Sure. I'll see.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Sure. All right. Let's see. Whenever you're ready, please.
Hey, please, the court. I was intending on starting back where Mr. Mark started with the language of Rule 50. I can start elsewhere if the court would like me to focus elsewhere.
Well, maybe you can just address you. He suggested, I guess, that you kind of concede that directed verdicts can be awarded partially.
Well,
do you concede that?
No, I think that's a misunderstanding. And when we're talking about partial verdicts under Rule 50, I'm not, and I don't think our arguments reflect that. Rule 50, what it talks about, it is very general. It talks about directing a verdict on a claim. It doesn't say a claim or multiple claims or what have you. And I think the distinction with Rule 56 and Rule 59 is that they do talk about granting summary judgment on some or all of the claim. Now, I agree that Rule 50 is silent, and I don't necessarily think that it's improper to direct a verdict on the entire claim. I think the distinction is whether or not it prevents a court to direct a verdict on with parts of the evidence and or a partial directed verdict on part of the claim that doesn't go to the essential elements thereof.
Well, how is that different from, for example, a motion in limine where you're simply ruling on a piece of evidence prior to trial? I mean, it almost sounds like you might be talking about, or your opposing counsel might be talking about simply ruling on the admissibility of certain kinds of evidence after the trial at the halftime.
Sure.
And that you're not advocating that.
No.
Okay. So we're not ruling on evidence. We're ruling on here's the evidence that's been admitted.
Right.
And now we have this Rule 50 motion prior to going to the jury.
Right. And I think the inquiry at that point is there a sufficient amount of evidence presented on each element of the claim to allow it to go to a jury. I think what you run into a problem with it if you start looking at what that evidence is and parsing out facts supported in part in support of one of the elements. I think the inquiry in terms of the Rule 50 motion is simply, did the plaintiff submit enough evidence for each element of the claim? If that answer is yes, the claim should go to the jury. I think that it differs from Rule 56 and Rule 59.
Can I back that up
Sure.
just a little bit? Instead of talking about the evidence with regard to particular elements here, it seems that Rule 56 is enough of an indication that the rules don't take the position that a claim cannot be divided for purposes of granting partial judgment.
Sure.
Could you articulate, quite apart from the language, we can make the argument about whether the omission, what that means. But could you articulate a reason why the rules would not want to similarly allow a partial judgment in the Rule 50 context as distinguished from the Rule 56 context?
Yes, and I think the distinction is in the Rule 56 context, you've got a court looking at the elements of a case and deciding, you know, this can come in, this cannot. Summary judgment is appropriate on this and not that. When you get to the Rule 50 motion, you've now presented an entire case to a jury. Jury is the one who's supposed to be a fact finder at that point. And so if you start at that point parsing out the evidence and telling the jury, well, hey, you can consider this part but not this part in support of a single claim and then allow it to go to a jury, it's confusing.
Maybe I cut you off too quick, but I thought in your response to Justice Rice, you were coming around to talking about whether there is sufficient evidence of an element. Could you break things up that way? But did you mean to be suggesting that the court couldn't decide there was insufficient evidence on a particular theory and therefore it could remove that theory from the jury.
Absolutely not. I do think that's appropriate because, but I think the difference is when you're talking about theories of liability, I mean, a lot of these case law cited in the briefs talks about a negligence, you know, negligence claims where the court directs a verdict as to one claim but not the other, and I think those, in that context, it's different because negligence claims are dependent on separate elements, and so there is no overlap. So if there isn't sufficient evidence for one of the negligence claim, I do think that directing a verdict is appropriate.
And
in
so
that instance.
Might that have been what your opposing counsel was referring to in terms of a concession? You do seem to be, if I'm understanding what you're saying right now, you're not saying that Rule 50 prohibits partial judgments.
No,
it's
on
just
an
that
entire
in this case, you think it mistakenly took away an element.
Right.
When it shouldn't have.
Right. And I don't think it's inappropriate. We're on an entire claim in and of itself, you know, because the rule is silent as to that. What I'm saying is that when you only got one claim and the court finds that you submitted sufficient evidence as to each element of the claim, when you start getting involved in parsing out what can be considered by the jury and what cannot, it's confusing. If we've made a prima facie case, let the claim go to the jury. That's what the jury is for.
Ms. Hodgson,
yes.
I'm over here. So do you think that if the court hadn't granted the directed verdict, do you think that tendered instruction that had been prepared where you have a series of ors should have been given in this circumstance? Do you know which instruction I'm referring to?
I do. And my recollection is that I'm not quite sure when that instruction was tendered. There was a lot of extraneous instructions being tendered during our jury instruction conference and after the partial directed verdict. I do think it would be appropriate because I suppose it probably in hindsight should have said and or. But if you're alleging a pattern of discriminatory conduct, I suppose it's possible that the jury could find discrimination on some of the decisions, but not others.
But if it were and, what I'm hearing from or reading from the trial court's determination at that time, you would have been granted the summary or the directed verdict would have been granted on the entire claim because the trial court determined you didn't prove this and that because you didn't have the comparator. Correct. I mean.
Correct, and I think that is why the court didn't give that instruction.
I understand, but I mean, if your interpretation is that it could have been given as and, mm-hmm. wasn't the trial court in a way more merciful to your clients by allowing the one to go forward because they were alleged as wars? Am I not making myself clear?
I guess
if it were a pattern and it was a series of you had to prove this and that,
sure.
I mean, all of those as ands,
right.
And you didn't prove one of those, then the court would have been within its authority to grant directed verdict as to the entire 1983 claim instead of surgically trying to allow that to be presented.
I don't think so because the series of decisions also goes, regardless of whether or not there's a comparator, the series of decisions goes to discriminatory intent. So I suppose it's possible that the jury could have inferred discriminatory intent based on the prior instructions, even though it only found a discriminatory motive as to one of those decisions.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Did you want to go?
Well, I'm looking at paragraph 65. Judge Fox's dissent. What's your response to her concern about manipulation? She talks about how a party should not be allowed to manipulate a trial court's duties simply by pleading multiple acts of misconduct within a single claim. Isn't that a risk under what you're proposing here?
It is, and I guess from my perspective, what the plaintiffs contended from the outset, what was a pattern, the pattern of conduct. I don't see how you you end up, you prove a pattern of conduct or discriminatory motive if you separate acts out into discrete, seven separate actions in terms of pleading at the get-go. By the time we get through trial, the jury's either going to find that discriminatory motive as to some or none of those decisions. And I think as long, provided that we showed sufficient evidence of discriminatory motive and similarly situated comparator, I think that the case should have gone to the jury. Does that answer your question?
That's fine, thank you.
Well, does that mean we don't have to construe the ruling? I mean, I'm serious. This has got a lot of implications, adding possibly language to the rule or an interpretation of the rule.
I don't think the rule there needs to be any change in the rule. I mean, I think the way it stands now is it allows the court, after hearing evidence, to direct a verdict. And the way that it doesn't say either way, but there has been some utilization by the courts in interpreting that to mean direct. You can direct a verdict on specific claims.
But you're saying the pleading was for a pattern of conduct for damages under 1983.
Sure.
The whole kit and caboodle, when you were deprived the opportunity to have your evidence in front of the jury.
Right. Well,
the trial judge carved it up under this rule that doesn't allow for carve-up.
Right. Right. And I think that may be a product of the nature of this particular claim.
Go ahead. Would you agree that you were not precluded from presenting any evidence? Because it all came in anyway, because your case had been completed, number one, and number two, it still could be considered for purposes of motive. It just reduced your burden to prove that one.
Well, the court did allow us to argue that at closing. But the problem was that after asserting a pattern of conduct, discriminatory conduct all through trial, the instruction that it got was, the jury ended up getting was, did the county discriminate against the plaintiffs with respect to the septic system bond requirement, period.
So I'd like to ask a question.
Sure.
So with respect to your trial management order, you basically talk about those same kinds of things that we're referring to as elements or portions. Mm-hmm. But in your trial management order, you indicate that there are examples of this kind of a conduct.
Right.
And then what doesn't hook up, though, is that when we go back to the jury instruction, which we've been talking about, it seems to limit your cause of action to only that one. The one thing that actually ended up going in, I can't find it right at the moment, but whatever that was, right?
Right, the trial management order does talk about, I mean, at that point, you have
it treats
to...
these things as examples. Mm-hmm. And if you look at your trial management order, it's not exactly clear that it's I guess it's clear. You say they engaged in an unusual conduct with respect to them, and interfered with their ability, and here are examples of the things that happened.
Right. Is your question, because it doesn't specifically say pattern and practice of discrimination? Well, I think by giving examples, four or five different examples of the manner in which plaintiffs were alleging the county discriminated against them. I understand that doesn't say pattern and practice, but...
Well, I guess what all of us are struggling with, speaking for myself only, but what we're concerned about, what I'm concerned about is, you know, your sort of classic way to look at a case, which is, you know, you have a cause of action and a claim which consists of elements. Mm-hmm. And you can have a number of cause of actions which make up a case. So lots of little pieces. It's hard here to find out exactly what your cause of action is, and you kind of refer to it differently in different places. So I can see why the judge was a little bit confused. But by the time you get to the jury instruction,
it has somehow been winnowed down to one cause of action, one assertion, if you will, of discrimination.
Right.
Do you agree with that assessment of the case?
Well, I think if you look back to, well, yes, when you get to the jury assertion, it is one pattern of this, or one pattern of conduct of discrimination. But that goes back to the original complaint as well, where plaintiffs alleged that they engaged in a course of conduct that was discriminatory in nature. Maybe the trial management order was not as articulate as it could have been, but I think you see it by giving various different examples. I think it fits with the pattern of, or the course of conduct that plaintiffs were alleging was discriminatory, because I don't know how you have a case where you're alleging discriminatory conduct and it's based on a pattern or just based on one decision. And that seems that was never what the plaintiffs were arguing in this case. They were always arguing, and we argued at trial, that these series of decisions bound up over time, where it became apparent to plaintiffs, at least, that it was based on their sexual orientation. It wasn't a situation where the very first adverse decision, you know, plaintiffs said, the motive must have been discriminatory. It built up over time. And so I don't know how that was the theory of the case the entire time. That was what we argued at trial. Obviously, the court's ruling, you know, significantly limited that, even though we were allowed to make the argument, when it came time to instruct the jury, they were asked simply whether or not that one decision was discriminatory in nature. And so the problem with the manner in which this happened is that essentially, plaintiff's theory that the series of decisions over time where proof was proof of discriminatory motive got taken away from the jury. And instead, they were asked to simply decide whether or not this one decision was discriminatory.
So you want this verdict set aside and you want to go to the jury on everything?
I'm sorry?
You want this verdict set aside and you want to go to jury on everything?
Yes.
All your theories for this pattern?
Yes.
Violation that entitles your clients to damages.
Yeah, I think because the court, despite what it did with the parsing of the evidence, because the court found that there was sufficient evidence as to each element. Yes,
Of one little piece.
Well,
the court only allowed one little piece of it to go, and you're just saying there was examples of a pattern.
Well, right. I mean, there was only one claim presented to the jury, so there was this one claim based on a pattern of conduct. And I think probably what should have happened is if the court thought that there was not a similar situated comparator in some of these instances, it should have let the claim go to the jury and instructed them that plaintiffs need to show a similarly situated comparator for each of these acts.
And I guess, counsel, I'm still struggling a little bit to square that with the instruction that was tendered that lays out these various acts in the disjunctive, you know, or any one of which, if proven to the jury, would entitle you to a judgment on the 1983 claim. So help me understand your description of the case that was presented to the jury with this instruction that was tendered that sort of breaks it out.
Well, I think it had to be probably had to be broken out, because it was difficult to craft an instruction where each decision could still be considered for discriminatory motive, but not as a court found, you know, as or but not as to, you know, to a similar situated comparator.
So is it, I mean, looking at that instruction, with the tendered instruction, would you have been arguing to the jury, hey, look, any one of these decisions, if you think any one of these decisions was motivated by discrimination, we're entitled to a verdict? in our favor?
No.
Or was your theory, this whole pattern, and here's examples, and collectively, if we've shown you that decision A and B and C and D collectively show a pattern of practice.
Yeah, our argument to the jury would have been these decisions, and here's what they are, amounted to a pattern and practice of discrimination. These series of decisions, at the very least, it goes for the discriminatory motive element, should still be considered.
Ms. Hodgson, weren't you allowed to do that? You were allowed to say they did this and this and this and this and this. That shows their motive in requiring the bond was discriminatory. I'm struggling with how you were precluded from presenting any evidence or making any argument in this case.
Well, we were permitted to present the evidence,
right?
And we were permitted to make the arguments at closing. However, but when it came, to these instructions that the jury was looking at, despite what we may have argued, they were simply only asked, is this one decision discriminatory?
Actually, the jury instruction says something like, consider whether or not the payment, the certificate of occupancy on their payment of a bond to cover the cost associated to the requiring them to have this bond was discriminatory. That's paragraph one, but then paragraph two says, the county employees or employees' different treatment of plaintiffs with respect to the foregoing decisions was based on intentional discrimination. So it seems to be even internally inconsistent.
That may have been a typographical error in the instruction, the reference to plural decisions.
Okay. So this jury instruction wasn't drafted very carefully. I gather that. But
apparently,
assuming that it's not drafted very carefully, they're still being presented with one of your issues. That is the being required to pay before they get a certificate of occupancy, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And that's the only thing that went to the jury.
Right.
And you, in your claim 5 or 6, whatever it was, wanted to have a whole bunch of things.
Sure. Okay. To establish a pattern of discriminatory conduct. Okay. Doesn't have any other questions? I just want to talk briefly about this case law, in the partial directed verdict. And I would just note that all of these cases in which the court directed a verdict on one claim or another, there just isn't a single case where the court got to the end of trial, found that there sufficient evidence as to each element of the claim, and then parse the evidence in terms of the factual basis for that claim. All the cases cited in the briefs, Observatory Corporation versus Daly, those were two separate negligence claims where verdict was directed on, where court directed verdict does come to as to one claim but not the other. Klein v. Sauer, that's a direct verdict on one negligence claim, not another. Mariani v. Rocky Mountain, direct verdict on two separate breach of contract claims. And I would just point out again that the difference here is that we had a single claim presented to the jury based on a pattern, and that may be an usable thing in terms of applying Rule 50. But at the end of the day, it was a single claim. And I know there was some concern in the briefs based on what would happen if this court were to affirm the Court of Appeals and not do anything in terms of amending Rule 50. There was some indication of, folks may go ahead and lump all negligence, you know, acts of negligence into a single claim for that purpose. It would lump all breach of contract claims into that claim for that purpose. I would just point out that the rules don't allow for that. Rule 10 requires that each claim be pled separately. If that's not done, Rule 12E permits a defendant to ask that that be done. So I think the concern in that respect is unwarranted. And I would just again point out that I think there is a reason why Rule 50 is different in language from the other rules. I mean, it's perfectly evident that where the drafters intended partial entry of judgment on some or parts of a claim that's expressly stated, Rule 50 is silent as to that. And I think that there is a reason for that. And it's, you know, once you get to a point where the case has been presented to a jury, as long as that evidence, or as long as the elements of that claim are sufficient, the claim should go to a jury. That's what we have. That's what we have juries for. And so I don't think anything else needs to be done in that regard. Does anybody else have any other questions?
Can I ask one factual question? Ultimately, what your clients wanted to get was a certificate of occupancy, correct? And basically what you're alleging is that there were a series of hurdles or roadblocks that were put in their way, preventing them from ultimately getting that certificate of occupancy.
Correct.
And that's kind of what you're referring to as the pattern, is the series of roadblocks.
Right.
Not that any one roadblock in particular was evidence of discrimination or of discriminatory intent, but the whole series as they went through the building process. Every time the county had an opportunity to make a decision, had to work first to them obtaining a certificate of occupancy, it did so.
Just move the finish line.
Exactly, and I know the court found that there wasn't sufficient evidence of similarly situated comparators as to some of those, or all but one of those decisions. Plaintiffs did produce evidence of comparators during trial. The court simply decided that they weren't similarly situated.
Okay. Let me ask, so I understand factually, that instruction that we've referenced earlier, instruction 28, that's got a line through that's now number 3, mm-hmm. was that the actual instruction that was then given?
I believe so, yeah. I believe the court changed the number.
Right. which I'm just trying to figure out what it's true. Okay. Thank you.
And so I guess, I'm sorry we're beating this to death, but we do that. So with respect to this instruction, it says, in making the decision to condition the plaintiff's receipt of a certificate of occupancy on their payment of a bond to cover the costs associated with repairs, they treated them more harshly, et cetera, et cetera. Now, were you concerned about other kinds of impediments to the certificate of occupancy than just a bond?
Yes.
So it would be your argument that, as Justice Boatwright put it, they kept moving the finish line farther and farther, but it was the bond the first time, something else the next time.
Right.
And so by limiting this instruction to only the bond, they were limiting your case.
Right.
Limiting consideration of all these other decisions that came before. I don't recall the exact order that the various decisions happened. All these other decisions that came before and after, the jury was foreclosed from considering them, at least for the purpose of discriminatory motive. I would still argue that the issue of similar situated comparator should have gone to the jury as to each of them, but that's beside the point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Or other than that, thank you. And I'll allow Mr. Marks to have his last minute.
I
I just want to make two points, I think, in rebuttal. The first point is that I think there's some element of divided error and acquiescence in this problem. The plaintiffs say that they had a pattern theory of multiple actions. Well, when it came time to address this on directed verdict, and the plaintiffs had an opportunity to disagree with the analytical framework of dividing each one of these decisions up and saying, is there a sufficient comparator? Is there evidence of intentional discrimination? Not once did they say, that's the wrong way to look at this case. Not once. They never protested that with the court's breakout of this or of my breakout of it. And had they had that kind of claim, one would expect them, and they were represented by good, competent counsel, to come out and say, that's not our case. Our case is this pattern of practice. So there's some element of invited error here.
You've got 1 second left.
Thank you.
Court will be in recess until this afternoon at 1:30.